The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. Quandary Phase.
Regular followers of the doings of Arthur Dent may have received an impression of his character and habits, which, while it includes the truth and, of course, nothing but the truth, fall short of the whole truth in all its glorious aspects. What, people ask, about all that stuff off in the wings between Arthur and Trillian? Did that ever get anywhere? What were they up to all those nights on the planet cricket? Studying French? Jogging? Indeed, why did she leave? This Arthur Dent comes the cry from the furthest reaches of the galaxy, and has even now been found inscribed on a deep space probe thought to originate from an alien world at a distance too hideous to contemplate. This Arthur Dent, what is he, man or mouse? Is he interested in nothing more than tea and hot baths? Has he no passion? Does he not, to put it in a nutshell, feel the need to copulate? Those who wish to know should listen on. Others with time travel projectors or functioning remote controls may wish to skip on to the next episode in this phase, which is a good bit and has Marvin in it.
I'll have to remember that you're the sort of person who can't hold on to a simple piece of paper for 2 minutes without winning a raffle with it.
If I believed in them, and I didn't have a past that featured events beyond the imagination of any ordinary mortal, I'd say finding you again was a bit of a miracle.
Hold my hand.
For Arthur, who can usually contrive to feel self-conscious if left alone long enough with a Swiss cheese plant, this moment is one of revelation. He feels like a cramped and zoo-born animal who awakes one morning to find the door to his cage hanging quietly open. From years of abandonment and bootless wandering, in exile from a planet that was destroyed in an encounter with the most unsympathetic bureaucracy in the cosmos, he has now regained his homeworld, his former life, and in Fenchurch, a woman for whom he would give it all up.
Did you know that there's something wrong with me?
Well, your brother mentioned some vague sort of...
Oh, Russell makes stuff up, because he can't deal with what it really is.
Then what is it? Can you tell me?
Don't worry, it's nothing bad at all. Just unusual. Very unusual. See if you can work it out.
All right. Your elbow. Your left elbow. There's something wrong with your left elbow.
Wrong. Completely wrong. You're on completely the wrong track.
This is not going to be easy. Hyde Park is stunning. You are stunning. Anyone who can go through Hyde Park with you on a summer's evening and not feel moved by it is probably going through in an ambulance with a sheet pulled over their face.
I think that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. Arthur, what are you doing?
I don't think it can be your bottom. Nothing I can see.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with my bottom.
I think I might have to tell you a story.
Okay.
Which will tell you something of the sort of things that happened to me.
Like a raffle ticket.
Yes, right. I had a train to catch. I arrived at the station. I was about 20 minutes early, so I bought a newspaper to do the crossword and went to the buffet to get a cup of coffee.
Did you solve it?
What?
The crossword.
I haven't had a chance to look at it yet. I'm still queuing for the coffee.
All right, then. Buy the coffee.
I'm buying it. I'm also buying some biscuits.
What sort?
Rich tea.
Ooh, good choice.
Now I go and sit at a table. This is the layout. Me sitting at the table. On my left, the newspaper. On my right, cup of coffee. In the middle of the table, packet of biscuits.
Yep, I see it.
What you don't see, because I haven't mentioned him yet, is the man sitting at the table already, opposite me. Briefcase, business suit. He didn't look as if he was about to do anything weird.
But he did.
He did. He leaned across the table, picked up the packet of biscuits, tore it open, took one out and ate it.
What?
He ate it.
What on earth did you do?
I did what any red-blooded Englishman would do. I was compelled to ignore it.
What? Why?
There was nothing anywhere in my upbringing, experience, or even primal instincts to tell me how to react to someone who quite calmly, sitting in front of me, stole one of my biscuits. There was nothing for it. I braced myself. I took a biscuit, trying very hard not to notice that the packet was already mysteriously open.
But you're fighting back, taking a tough line.
After my fashion, yes. And I ate the biscuit. I ate it very deliberately, so that he would have no doubt as to what I was doing. And when I eat a biscuit, it stays eaten.
So what did he do?
Took another one. He took it. He ate it. Clear as daylight. And, having not said anything the first time, it was somehow even more difficult for me to broach the subject the second time around. So, I ignored it with, if anything, even more vigour than previously, and took another biscuit. And for an instant, our eyes met.
Like this?
Well, no, not quite like this. But they met, just for an instant. And we both looked away. And so we went through the whole packet. Him, me, him, me.
The whole packet?
Well, it was only 8 biscuits, but it seemed like a lifetime. When the empty packet was lying dead between us, the man at last got up, having done his worst, and left. As it happened, my train was announced a moment or two later, so I finished my coffee, stood up, picked up the newspaper, and underneath the newspaper...
Yes?
...were my biscuits.
What?
True. I'd been eating his all the time.
You complete pillock. You completely and utterly foolish person.
Your turn. Tell me a story. Tell me your story.
I'll try. But maybe you should know that I suffer from sudden, startling revelations.
Are you about to have a fit or something?
No, no. I can tell when it's going to happen. For days before, the strangest feeling builds in me, as if I was being connected into something.
Does the number 42 mean anything to you at all?
Oh, Arthur, this is serious.
I'm being serious. Tell me your story. Don't worry if it sounds odd. Believe me, you're talking to someone who has seen a lot of weird stuff, and I'm not talking biscuits here.
Okay. Thing is, it was so simple when it came.
What was?
That's what I don't know. And the sense of loss is getting unbearable. I was in a cafe in Rickmansworth, having a cup of tea. This was after days of this build-up, becoming connected up. I was sort of buzzing, gently. And I was watching some work going on a building site opposite, over the rim of my teacup, which is the nicest way of watching other people working. And suddenly, there it was in my mind. This message from somewhere. And it was so simple. It made such sense of everything. I just sat up and thought, oh, well, that's all right then. I was so startled, I almost dropped my teacup. In fact, I think I did drop it. Yeah, I'm sure I did. That was the point at which it seemed to me, quite literally, as if the world exploded.
What?
I know everybody talks about big yellow spaceships and how the whole thing was a hallucination. But if it was, then I have hallucinations in big screen 3D surround sound and should probably hire myself out to people who are bored with movies. It was as if the ground was ripped from under my feet. And I woke up in hospital. I've been in and out ever since. And that's why I seem to have a fear of sudden revelations that everything's going to be all right.
Yes. Yes, I do too. I fought it, but I do. You say you felt as if the Earth actually exploded.
Yes, more than felt.
Which is what everybody else says is hallucinations.
Yes, but people think if you just say hallucinations, it explains anything you want. But it's just a word. It doesn't explain anything. It doesn't explain why the dolphins disappeared.
No. No. What?
Doesn't explain why the dolphins disappeared.
Which dolphins do you mean?
What do you mean, which dolphins? I'm talking about when all the dolphins disappeared.
The dolphins?
Yes.
You're saying the dolphins all disappeared?
Arthur, where have you been, for heaven's sake? The dolphins all disappeared on the same day.
Where did they go?
No one knows. Well, there is one man who says he knows, but he lives in California, so people say he's balmy. I was thinking of going to see him. It's the only lead I've got on what happened to me.
Better to go in search of the truth than pretend it isn't there.
Arthur, I really would like to know where you've been. I think something terrible happened to you as well. That's why we recognised each other.
Mine's a very long story, and confusing even for me.
Well, now you've got someone you can tell. Well, the bits I hadn't already found out on this.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Why does it say don't panic on the cover?
I think it's a get-out clause for the warranty. This particular one has been hurled into prehistoric rivers, baked in the deserts of Cacrafoon, dropped into the oceans of Santorginus V, frozen on the glaciers of the moon of Jaglan Beta, sat on, kicked around spaceships, scuffed and generally abused. Its makers think these are exactly the sorts of things that might happen to it, so they wrote on it, in large friendly letters, the words "Don't panic," hoping no one would ask for their money back.
Have you been to many of these places?
A few.
Can we go to them?
Do you want to?
Yes, I want to know what the message was I lost and where it came from. I don't think it came from here. I'm not even sure that I know where here is. But I need to find it, Arthur. Not knowing is damaging me. Anyway, there is something wrong with part of me, and you've got to find out what it is. You can try and guess on the way home. Come on.
The problem with The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or rather one of the problems, for there are many clogging up civil, commercial and criminal courts all over the galaxy, especially the more corrupt ones, is this: change. The galaxy is a rapidly changing place. A bit of a nightmare, you might think, for a scrupulous and conscientious editor, diligently striving to keep abreast of all the changes that arise every minute of every hour of every day, and you would be wrong. The editor, like all the editors the guide has ever had, has no real grasp of the meanings of the words scrupulous, conscientious, or diligent, and prefers to get his nightmares through a straw. Entries tend to get updated or not across the sub-ether net according to if they read good. Thus, the entry Ford Prefect filed on the subject of Vogons, while lacking in strict accuracy, was vitriolic enough to qualify for inclusion.
Vogons are one of the most unpleasant races in the galaxy. Not actually evil, but bad-tempered, bureaucratic, officious, and callous. Their constructor fleet ships look as if they have been not so much designed as congealed. Uglier things have been spotted in the skies, but not by reliable witnesses. In fact, to see anything much uglier than a Vogon ship, you would have to go inside and look at a Vogon, or worse, inside one. Anatomical analysis of the Vogon reveals that its brain was originally a badly deformed, misplaced, and dyspeptic... dyspeptic liver. Consequently, thinking is not really something Vogons are cut out for. The fairest thing you can say about them, then, is that they know what they like, and what they like mostly involves hurting people and, wherever possible, getting very angry.
On second thoughts, it's accurate enough.
All persons here to do business at the Galactic Hyperspace Planet Council, take your seats. The rest of you find something to occupy yourselves before I come and find it for you. Call the first witness.
Call Prostetnik Vogon Jilts.
Call Prostetnik Vogon Jilts.
Call Prostetnik Vogon Jilts.
Call Prostetnik Vogon Jilts.
Call Prostetnik. That's me.
Quiet! Who coughed? Hold up. Clark, shoot anyone who coughs.
Yes, your vastness. Right.
Prostetnik Vogon Jilts, you are responsible for clearing the interstellar hyperspace link between Demosthenes and Ursa Minor. Your orders were to demolish all planets on that route in accordance with the plans we lodged at Alpha Centauri. Your report clearly stated that the planet known as the Earth was destroyed by your demolition fleet. Now, a survey of the area has revealed Earth is still there. I put it to you that you have royally screwed the pooch.
It is a tissue of lies. I deny it utterly. And I volunteer for mucking out duty in the beast compounds on trial rather than live a day longer with this vicious smear on my character.
Laudable though it is for you to take an adversarial stance in your desperate situation, I have here holographic plates of the planet in question, received last week. Bit screen on.
Bugger. You're right. I'm guilty as charged.
Really?
Well, I can't argue with the evidence. There it is, in black and white, and blue, and brown, and wispy, white, cloudy bits. Well, that's the Earth, all right.
Haven't had a good bit of torture in weeks.
Say, Your Honour,
he's been saving up some really excruciating poems for this. Don't spoil it by agreeing.
Shut up! What does the defendant have to say for himself?
Well, I don't like leaving a job unfinished any more than the next Vogon. All right, the Vogon beside him.
From this evidence, it doesn't look as if the job was ever started.
I swear we destroyed that planet. I know we did. We even had a couple of hitchhikers steal aboard trying to escape. Of course, we threw them out of the airlock.
Dent, Arthur, Prefect Ford?
Well, probably. Or humans all look alike to me. Freeloading parasites.
According to the log, you picked up ex-President Beeblebrox, too.
No. He rescued them.
Oh, yes. Then we had him lured into the total perspective vortex. Probably still there. And no bad thing. Now, about this Earth. Seems it exists in a plural sector. Very unstable dimensionally. Very hard to destroy planets like that. They exist on several levels. Keep popping back into reality.
I have the precedent here, Your Honour. Vogon Imperium versus Megabrantis Liposuction Inc. Ruling nature abhors a vacuum.
Yeah, whatever, girlfriend. I'll just keep destroying the Earth till nature settles for a bloody vacuum.
Thank you. The problem has, however, compounded itself somewhat. Now that improbability travel has become so popular, hyperspace bypasses have become somewhat, well, passé.
I see. And what does that mean?
We don't actually need to demolish Earth.
Oh.
However, an order cannot be countermanded once it has been seen to be issued.
The paperwork was registered with all galactic sectors.
Precisely. We must not be seen to be lax in matters bureaucratic.
So I can destroy it.
Orders are orders, Prestechnik Vogon Jokes.
Yes!
But given the planet's plural location, we need to approach the problem in a circuitous manner. What I have in mind is... Oh, excuse me.
Orders are orders.
It's two blurters?
What you have in mind is to use... First syllable sounds like... Bleeding... Coughing... Dying...
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has several entries claiming to have found the most romantic location in the known universe. One, for example, is Brequinder on the Foth of Avalars, famed in myth as the home of the magical Forlornis fire dragons. In ancient days, when the air was sweet and the nights fragrant, but everyone somehow managed to be, or so they claimed, virgins, it was not possible to heave a brick on Brequinder in the Foth of Avalars without hitting at least half a dozen Forlornis fire dragons. Whether you'd want to do that is another matter. Not that fire dragons weren't an essentially peace-loving species, but one so often hurts the one loves, especially if one is a Forlornis fire dragon, with breath like a rocket booster and teeth like a park fence. Add to all that the relatively small number of madmen who actually went around the place heaving bricks, and you end up with a lot of people on Brequinder in the Foth of Avalars getting seriously hurt by dragons and bricks. But did they mind? They did not. The Forlornis fire dragons were revered throughout the land for their savage beauty, their noble ways, and their habit of biting people who didn't revere them. Why was this? The answer was simple. There is something almost unbearably sexy about having huge fire-breathing magical dragons flying low about the sky on moonlit nights, which are already dangerously on the sweet and fragrant side. No sooner would a flock of half a dozen silk-winged Forlornis fire dragons fly across the evening horizon than half the people of Brequinder were scurrying off into the woods with the other half, to emerge with the dawn, all smiling and happy and still claiming, rather endearingly, to be virgins, if rather flushed and sticky virgins. The place was always stiff with researchers trying to get to the bottom of it all and taking a very long time about it. Not surprisingly, the guide's description of this planet has proved to be so popular that it's never been taken out, and thus latter-day hitchhikers have to find out for themselves that, like the dinosaurs, the dodos, and the greater drubbered Wintwok of Stegbartel Major in the constellation of Fraz, the Falornis fire dragons face certain extinction, and modern Braquinda in the city-state of Avalars is now little more than concrete, strip joints, and dragon burger bars. There are, of course, no Falornis fire dragons in the Islington Mews where Fenchurch lives, but if by any chance there were, they might just as well slope off across the road for a pizza, for they're not needed.
Your knee? There is something terribly and tragically wrong with your left knee. Right knee?
Both knees are absolutely fine.
Forgetting your calves, which I can't, by the most sensuous process of elimination, it has to be your feet.
Ah.
I have to admit, I really don't know what I'm looking for.
I'll give you a clue. Pick me up. Mm-hmm. Kiss me again. Mm-hmm. Now let me stand up. Well?
It is the feet. But they look okay. On top. And underneath.
You're getting warmer.
Good grief, I see what's wrong with your feet. They don't touch the ground.
So, what do you think?
Well, I'm guessing you're an inch taller than you were before the dolphins disappeared.
I suppose so.
Which probably means, I wonder, is this the old hayloft door?
Yes. Careful, Arthur. We're two floors up.
Mind if I pop outside for a minute?
Arthur! How are you doing that? What are you standing on?
Nothing. Come on out. The air's lovely.
You think I can?
I'm sure of it. No, don't bring anything. Think about tulips or lost items of hand luggage.
Your seat is in the upright position and your seatbelt firmly fastened. Thank you. Oh, not again.
Do you want me to go?
Oh, it's okay. I'll deal with her. Excuse me. Yes, sir. Mrs. Kapinski?
Kepperson.
You pressed your call button.
Did I?
Something wrong?
Well, I thought you might know.
Is it the headphones again?
No.
The child in front making milk come out of his nose again?
No.
Mrs. Capelson, is it something outside the plane? You're staring.
Yes, well, you know, I've seen a lot of life.
I'm sorry?
I've been puzzled by some, but I do feel I was bored with a lot of it. It's all been very pleasant, but perhaps a little too routine.
Right.
I thought I just saw, but then I didn't. Well, I did, two of them, but it's nothing to worry about.
So you don't need help?
Oh, no. I just needed to tell someone. Thank you.
No problem.
I didn't know you could do it on the wing of a plane, though.
Try a swoop!
What?
Like this. Whee!
I'm flying!
Don't think about it.
Think about what?
That's the idea.
Can we do this every night?
Maybe not so close to the Heathrow flight path.
Coward!
I know. Tomorrow we'll bring music and two sets of earphones.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was conceived as a reference work dedicated to the pursuit of cheap travel, cheap food, and the cheapest possible intoxicants. As a result, it can fail entirely to include certain very necessary entries, such as how to report a pair of flying people using the aerofoil of a commercial jetliner to consummate their affections, or which methods to conquer insomnia work best in the noisy confines of huge spacecraft. This latter omission is no longer of significance to Ford Prefect, who snores cocooned in towels and well-thumbed copies of Playbeing, deaf to the traffic of flying ratchet screwdrivers, in a maintenance hatchway aboard the Zaxxisian robot ship, dreaming fitfully of old haunts, like the east side of New York, where the river has become so extravagantly polluted that new life forms are now emerging from it spontaneously, demanding welfare and voting rights.
Hello. Excuse me, I'm sorry to bother you, but I need some help.
Sure, what can I do for you?
Well, I just oozed up out of the river. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty much new to the surface. Is there any useful information you can give me?
Phew, well, I can tell you where some bars are, I guess.
What about love and happiness? I sense deep needs in myself for things like that. You got any leads there?
Well, only that you can get most of what you require around 7th Avenue.
Oh, okay. Tell me the truth. Am I or am I not, in your opinion, beautiful?
Well, to me, not. But listen, most people make out, you know? Are there any more like you in the river?
How should I know? It's a filthy, disgusting place. Lady Water, you can't see a tentacle in front of your face.
No, fair enough. Stupid question.
Listen, I'm new here. Life is entirely strange to me. What's it like?
Now, this is something that I can speak about with some authority.
Good. Tell me everything. I'm all ears.
Yes, you are, where you're not all tentacles.
Hey, schmuck, I need the tentacles to clean out the ears. What about life? Please, tell me, I'm listening.
Life? Life is like a grapefruit.
Life is like a grapefruit. Then help me out here. Metaphors are not my field either. Could you please describe to me in concrete terms how life is like a grapefruit? Use your hands if it helps.
Well, it's sort of orangey-yellow and dimpled on the outside, wet and squidgy in the middle. It's got pips inside, too. Oh, and some people have half of one for breakfast.
This is advice I could use. Is there anyone else in this dream that I could talk to?
I don't know. Look, ask a policeman. Ask anybody but me. I'm going to roll over and dream about girls, air cars, single malt. Oh, yes. Oh, lovely.
That's great. Go back to sleep. See if I can. You think I'm going to wake this whole thing out by myself? I got to put on my slippers and go to the bathroom anyway.
Oh, elevensies. What a treat.
My pleasure.
This is all very wonderful.
The sandwich?
Everything. But I do still feel I need to know what's happened to me. You see, there's this difference between us. That you lost something and found it again. And I found something and lost it. I need to find it again.
Yes, I know. And I've had an idea. Pass the phone. Murray Bost Henson is a journalist on one of those papers with small pages and big print.
It doesn't sound like he's much of a journalist.
He isn't, but he's the only one I knew. Or rather...
I'm late for my cello lesson. Back soon. Good luck.
Thanks.
Yep.
Murray.
Arthur Dent?
Yes.
Arthur, my old soup spoon, my old silver tureen, how particularly stunning to hear from you. Someone told me you'd gone off into space or something.
What?
Oh, just a rumour, my old elephant tusk, my little green beige card table. Got it from someone who picked up a hitchhiker in Somerset. Probably means nothing at all, but I may need a quote from you.
Oh, well then, I deny it.
Oh, that's perfect, thank you. Fits like a what's-it in one of those other things with the other stories of the week, that denial. Excuse me, something's just fallen out of my ear. Good Lord.
Murray?
I just remembered what an odd evening I had last night.
Anyway, my old, I won't say what, we're calling this the Week of the Weirdos. Got a ring to it, don't you think? You see, we have this man it always rains on.
What?
This is the absolute stocking-top truth, all documented in his little black book. It all checks out. The Met Office is going ice-cold, thick banana whips. This man is the bee's knees, Arthur. He is the wasp's nipples. He is, I would go so far as to say, the entire set of erogenous zones of every major flying insect in the Western world. We're calling him the Rain God. Nice, don't you think?
I think I've met him.
Incredible. You met the Rain God?
If it's the same man. I told him to stop complaining and show someone his book.
Well, you did a bundle, Arthur.
Do you know how much tour operators are paying him not to go abroad this year? Listen, we may want to do a feature on you, Arthur. The man who made the Rain God rain. Got a ring to it. Photograph you under a garden shower, but that'll be okay. Where do I send the snapper?
I'm in Islington.
Listen, man.
Islington, home of the real weirdness of the week, the real seriously loopy stuff. Do you know anything about these flying people?
No.
Arthur, where have you been? Oh, space, right. Yes, I got your denial, didn't I? But that was months ago. Listen, it's night after night this week by old cheese grater, right on your patch. This couple, they just fly around the sky and start doing all kinds of stuff. And I don't mean looking through walls or pretending to be box girder Bridges. You don't know anything?
No.
Arthur, it's been inexpressibly delicious conversing with you, chum bum, but I have to go. I'll send the guy round with the camera and the hose. Give me the address, I'm already writing.
Oh, listen, Murray, I called to ask you something.
I want to find out something about the dolphins.
Oh, no story. Last year's news. Forget them, they're gone. So is the story.
Murray, I'm not interested in whether it's a story. I just want to find out how I can get in touch with that man in California who claims to know something about it. I thought you might know.
Him? Oh, my old herringbone tweed. Why didn't you say so?
This is an important announcement. This is flight 121 to Los Angeles. If your travel plans today do not include Los Angeles, now would be the perfect time to disembark. Thank you.
When you said meet me at the airport, I didn't think you'd be bringing our passports and a pair of plane tickets.
Sorry about that. I remembered your toothbrush, though.
Look at you. Drenched with sweat.
Not with sweat. A photographer came round. I tried to argue, but... well, never mind. I spoke to California...
You spoke to him?
I spoke to his wife, Mrs. Watson, and asked to speak to him. She said he was too weird to come to the phone right now, and could I call back? So I did. And she said he was 3.2 light-years from the phone, and I should call again.
Ah. Seatbelt done up, miss?
Yes, thanks.
I called again. She said the situation had improved. He was now a mere 2.6 light-years from the phone, but it was still a long way to shout.
I didn't realise it was that bad.
I phoned again. Her name, by the way, and you may wish to know this, is Arcane Jill.
I see.
She explained that the phone is in a room that he never comes into. It's in the asylum. He does not like to enter the asylum. She felt it might save me phoning. He will only meet people outside the asylum. I asked her where the asylum is, and she asked if I'd ever read the instructions on a packet of toothpicks.
And did you?
I didn't have a packet to hand. Then she hung up. I actually got the address from a guy on a science magazine.
I'm not sure I understand.
Neither do many people. I have been told that Mr. Watson claims to have regular meetings with angels who wear golden beards and green wings and orthopedic sandals.
But you think it's worth it?
Well, the one thing that everyone agrees on, apart from the fact that he is barking mad, is that he does know more than any man living about dolphins.
And what's his name again?
Wonko the Sane.
I know he will be able to help us. I know he will.
Excuse me, my dears. I get so bored on these long flights. It's nice to talk to somebody. My name's Enid Capelson. I'm from Boston. Tell me, do you fly a lot?
Hello.
Hello.
I am John Watson, but you can call me Wonko the Sane.
Arthur Dent.
You have a very interesting house. It's inside out.
It gives me pleasure. Here.
Thank you. We've come to ask you about the dolphins.
Ah, yes. Them.
Your wife mentioned toothpicks.
Yes. That's to do with the day I finally realized that the world had gone totally crazy. So I built the asylum to put it in. Poor thing, hoping it would get better.
I'm horribly confused. Up there, you've got carpet up to the curb of the Pacific Coast Highway. Your exterior walls are hung with bookshelves and pictures, and the sign above the front door says, come outside. So here we are, inside, sitting by a garden path surrounded by rough brick walls.
Here we are, outside the asylum. When you go back through the door there, to where you parked your ride, you go inside the asylum. I never go myself. If I am tempted, I simply look at the sign.
That one?
Hold stick near center of its length. Place pointed end in mouth. Insert in tooth space, blunt end next to gum. Use gentle in-out motion.
And those are the instructions on...
On a set of toothpicks. It seemed to me that any civilization that had so far lost its head as to need to include a set of instructions in a packet of toothpicks was no longer one in which I could live and stay sane.
But you are...
Oh, I call myself Wonko the Sane, to reassure people. Wonko is what my mother called me when I was a clumsy kid. Knocking things over, and sane is what I intend to remain. And the angels with the golden beards and green wings and orthopedic sandals agree with me.
And they visit when?
Weekends, mostly. On little scooters. They are great machines.
I see.
Why not?
Pardon?
Why not scooters? Others might fly. Here, they're on scooters. Think about it, Arthur.
Yes. Yes, of course. Who's to say? What's impossible?
About the dolphins.
I can show you the sandals.
I'll
get them. The angels say that they suit the terrain they have to work in. They say they run a concession stand by the message. When I say I don't know what that means, they say, no, you don't, and laugh.
The message?
Arthur?
Here. Perfectly ordinary wooden-soled sandals. Look, I'm not trying to prove anything here. I'm a scientist. I know what constitutes proof. I use my childhood name to remind myself that a scientist must also be like a child. If he sees a thing, he must say that he sees it, whether it's what he was expecting to see or not. Otherwise, he'll only see what he's expecting. I also thought you might like to see this.
Where did you get that bowl?
Fenchurch, have you seen one of these before?
I've got one. Or at least I did have. Russell nicked it to put his golf balls in. Have you got one?
I found it by my bed.
Both of you have one of these bowls? With the inscription?
So long and thanks for all the fish.
Yes. Do you know what it is?
No.
It is a farewell gift from the dolphins. The dolphins whom I loved and studied and swam with and fed with fish and even tried to learn their language, a task which they made impossibly difficult, considering they were perfectly capable of communicating in ours if they'd wanted to. What have you done with yours?
I keep a fish in it.
You've done nothing else? No. If you had, you would know. My wife, she kept wheat germ in ours till last night.
What happened last night?
We ran out of wheat germ. She's gone to the store to get some more. Well, I washed the bowl and dried it, and then I held it to my ear. You ever held one to your ear?
No.
Perhaps you should.
May we?
Closer. Closer. Well, that's good. Now, with your fingernail. Gently.
This bone was brought to you by the campaign to save the humans. We bid you farewell.
What message will Arthur and Fenchurch discover next? Will Ford Prefect be on hand to utterly confuse and annoy everybody? And if the rumors are true, is Marvin going to make his farewell appearance? The next episode of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy spells out the answers.
In that episode of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, William Franklin was the book. Simon Jones played Arthur Dent, Jeffrey McGiven, Ford Prefect, and Jane Horrocks was Fenchurch. Stephen Fry was Murray Bost Henson, and Jackie Mason, the East River creature. Dominic Hawksley was the Vogon Councillor, Simon Greenall, the Steward, Margaret Robertson, Mrs. Cappelson, Michael Kuehl, the Vogon Clerk, and Toby Longworth was Prostetnik Vogon Jelts. Christian Slater played Wonko the Sane. The announcer was John Marsh, the surround mix was by Paul Dealey, and additional effects by Ken Humphrey and Paul Weir. The script editor was John Langdon, and the music was by Paul Wicks Wickens. The production manager was Joe Wheeler, and the production assistant was Susie Matthews. The programme was adapted, directed, and co-produced by Dirk Maggs. The producers were Helen Chattel and Bruce Hyman, and it was an above-the-title production for BBC Radio 4. The BBC wishes to advise listeners that not all glass bowls contain messages from the dolphins when pinged. Certain ovenware, for example, will emit serving suggestions for tasty puddings, but any bowl stamped by a bathroom fittings manufacturer is best left unpinged altogether.